Carlita Rinaldi said, "Fundamentally, schools are places of research, cultivating attitudes of research and capacities for lifelong learning. Schools and teachers have a responsibility to be listeners. Listening is an attitude to the ideas, questions, and answers of children, and then struggling to make meaning from what is said without preconceived ideas of what is correct or valid." Join me, Sandy Lanes, as my guest today shares beautiful stories of listening in his role as a nature and technology studio teacher. He will share his insights as he continues to become awakened to Reggio. Josh Rifkin is a technology and nature specialist at the Steinberg Loop JCC in Denver, Colorado. In his role, he collaborates with classroom teachers and children to design intentional learning experiences that emerge from the theories of children. Josh recently completed a three-year fellowship with the Sheva Learning Institute, joined the board of the FSHAR project, and gives inspiring workshops sharing about his work. I had the privilege of helping to lead a trip to a study institute to Reggio Emilia, on which I got to know Josh. And following that, I've had years of conversations in which he's been a huge stimulation for my own thinking with his stories directly from the classroom in real time. Josh, you are a lifelong learner, always asking questions, always seeking resources, always trying to go deeper in your processes. And I'm so glad that you're here. Welcome, Josh.
Well, thank you, Sandy. I am also so glad that I'm here. I'm sure that I have told you this before, but I think that this podcast is really a gift to the field. Thanks for having me here.
So as I always do, I'm going to start by asking you about your journey with the Reggio approach.
I think my journey began probably around 2010. I had just joined the JCC in Denver Early Childhood Center. It was kind of a special time for the school. They were going through a major transition. We had two leaders that were sort of leading what was going on in terms of the transition. They were kind of like in coaching positions, trying to help deepen the learning that was happening in the school and really trying to embrace progressive ideas around education. There was Lori Ryan, who had worked with Louise Caldwell in St. Louis. And there was our mutual friend, Judy Morshak, who was the pedagogical director of what is now called the FSHAR project. And that's really how my introduction began. And I think, like many educators, when I first entered that situation, it certainly wasn't an awakening to Reggio, but I think I spent a lot of time sort of becoming acquainted to Reggio.
Wow, and a new podcast emerges.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of us spend a lot of time in that space. I felt sort of like a collector of all these pieces of the puzzle. And I'm not sure that at that time that they really were communicating with each other. It was just, they sort of seemed loosely connected to me at the time. There were pieces about honoring the image of the child, and the 100 languages that children express themselves. There were things about intelligent materials, and things about teachers as researchers, and the importance of relationships, but they all sort of existed in different pockets and didn't really connect with one another. That started to change for me when Lori Ryan at one point did become our director. And she was really key and instrumental in developing this outdoor learning space. Her contribution to that space was really creating this space and imagining this space. And at one point, she approached me and said, "I have some different ideas about the career direction that I want to pursue. And I'm going to be leaving the JCC. There's a space. I'm really looking for sort of a steward for this space before I leave." And I probably had been teaching for about a year or so, like didn't know a lot about taking care of an outdoor space, didn't know a lot about gardening or keeping plants alive, but I think what she had observed in me was I was curious about, you know, we were growing seedlings in the classroom, and that was sort of the extent of my knowledge of how to grow things. And so she asked me, are you, you know, would you be willing to take on this space? I agreed to it and really had no idea what to do with this space or how to keep it alive or how to learn with children in the space. And I think that this was sort of the moment that everything kind of changed for me, in that I started to learn in this time how to think with children. And I began to learn how to take care of that space by being in that space with children. I think I came to it all so new. My curiosity was probably contagious to them, and their curiosity was contagious to me. And we sort of went about this business of, one, how to even keep this thing alive, and two, how to learn in that space. And I think of this one story that really makes me think of where I started to learn how to co-construct knowledge with children. There was this girl named Chelsea. I think she was probably 4 or so, and she had really taken a keen interest in the garden, and she was very observant about the things that were happening in the garden. And she was kind of my shadow for that year. You know, she would, whenever we were watering, there she was. Whenever we were looking at what was growing, there she was. And I kind of felt like her shadow too, because she was just examining the garden in a way that I guess only children can do. And I was very intrigued by that. I remember there was one bed that we had decided to grow strawberries in. And one day I see her, she sort of sat herself by this bed, and I see her starting to pick some of the leaves off of the strawberry bed. And it takes me by surprise, because she was really, really good at sort of nurturing this space and respecting the space. And here I see her like picking all these leaves off the strawberry. And I go up to her and I'm, Chelsea, what are you doing? Why are you picking the plants? Why are you picking the strawberries? And she looks at me and goes, well, these aren't strawberries. And I'm like, yeah, they are. This is a strawberry bed, and you're picking all the leaves. This, you're surprising me. You know, usually you're so respectful in this space. And she goes, these aren't strawberries. And I go, what do you mean? She goes, here. And she pulls a leaf off and she goes, smell it. And I smell it, and it has this sort of lemon fragrance. And I realize that she's right, that they aren't strawberry plants, that there was some sort of like residual lemon balm that had come back up. And lemon balm is so plentiful that it's really fine to pick. And she taught me in that moment sort of what was happening in that space. And that for me sort of is a really good example of how children started to teach me about that space.
This really makes me think a lot about gardens, and so many schools and educators have been talking about the gardens in their schools. And a lot of the conversations seem to be pretty surface, in that the way they're approaching the garden is somebody, maybe with the children or not, plants something. They watch how they watch the plants grow. They pick the plants. They maybe eat what comes from it. But I know that for you, you see the garden in a much deeper way with the children, as you just showed us in that story. And I'm thinking about, how do we begin seeing the garden as a context for meaning making and ongoing dialogue between the children and the garden and each other, and not just a science experiment?
I would start by saying that if you have a garden in your school and children are walking into that space, and they're having a good time there, and they are seeing plants with recognizable vegetables connected to them, that you should already give yourself a pat on the back. That is something that's not easy to cultivate in a school, that there's all kinds of logistics about keeping that space alive. And it meets a lot of goals that I think a lot of people have around having an outdoor classroom or a garden. And I think that those goals are around, one, helping children create a connection to where their food comes from. In this day and age where it's so easy to get things from the grocery, kids really get disconnected from where is this food coming from? And seeing a recognizable vegetable connected to a plant does a huge service in meeting that goal. And I think a second goal that a lot of people have is this idea of creating a connection to nature. The kids are spending a lot less time in nature, and that we don't want them to lose that connection, because that's going to be really essential as we are hoping to have a generation of stewards that will not only take care of nature, but to take care of the planet. So if you have that in your school, and kids are, if you've managed to get the space, you've managed to keep the plants alive, and kids are having a relatively pleasant time in that area, then good for you. And there is opportunities to take that even deeper. There are so many stories, yeah, where I have been a part of children making meaning in that space. I think one of the things that educators really struggle with when it comes to gardens is you have this really sort of active time where, you know, it happens around spring, and everybody's very busy, and there's a lot of planting, and there's a lot of business in the garden, and then everything gets kind of set, and then educators are like, okay, so now what do we do? Like, what's the business? What are we doing? And I think this story kind of speaks to where it can go. One of the beauties of the garden is that the space is such a rich one that I think it really invites children to enter into a world of fantasy, that if we give them time to be into that space, they will just enter into a world of very rich dramatic play. And I think as a garden educator, one of our jobs is to, we're making sure that they have all the tools and all the props to make that world of fantasy come alive. And I remember this one day last year, we bring a lot of like loose parts into the garden. And one of the loose parts that we had brought in was, they were these sort of old film reels. Imagine like these like large kind of donut looking film reels, and they all had a hole going through it. The kids had stacked these reels and kind of lined up the holes. And I'm listening to these kids playing with these reels, I hear them talking about how they've created this porthole, that the hole down in between the reels is actually a porthole. And I hear this girl talking about, yeah, this is a porthole, and you can enter the porthole, and it will either take you to Candyland, or I can't remember all the things. There were a variety of places that you could slide into this porthole, and you would come out into a different land. And I was just so intrigued with this idea. It just felt like such an advanced concept, this idea of a portal. These are like concepts that I thought about like in an advanced physics class. I asked them, what is it like when you go into the portal? And they explained that, you know, when you go in, it's like very dark and you don't know where you're going. And then all of a sudden you just kind of emerge into another land. I kind of held on to that story. And simultaneously inside the garden, a lot of the garden learning is sort of motivated or driven by what we consider in Oreggio-inspired philosophy, this idea of a third teacher. And certainly in the garden, it's pushed along by this teacher, which is nature itself, and sort of the rhythms of the seasons and the rhythms of things that happen in that space. At that time, it was a really bad year for Japanese beetles. I don't know if you've seen these Japanese beetles. They look like kind of metallic flies, and they just decimate the garden. they were just eating our plants. And I had this sort of dilemma about what exactly to do with these Japanese beetles. We had to get rid of them. And I had the children helping me pulling them off of plants, and we would put them in a jar, and then they sort of like magically disappeared. But I started to wonder, like, what sort of conversation should we have about these Japanese beetles? Like, and one day this girl came into the garden and explained that they also had Japanese beetles at their garden, at their home, and that her dad would take the Japanese beetles and drown them in soapy water. And that's actually, in fact, what I was doing with them too. I was just kind of doing it offsite. And I just began to wonder, like, is this a conversation we should be having with children? And I actually put it towards the families. How do we deal with insects that are pests? Do we have real conversations about, should we kill them? Should we relocate them? It was a dialogue that was really, I think, interesting for the parents, that they also were sort of in this dilemma of, what exactly do we do with these pests? So I decided to have an honest conversation with them. I told them, you know, I was kind of in this dilemma that on one hand, I respected the life in the garden and didn't want to kill any insects. But at the same time, if we were going to let these insects stay, they were going to really decimate the plants. And I asked them, like, what do you think we should do? And this group that had been playing with the porthole said, I think we should take the Japanese beetles, and I think we should put them in the portal. And it was just such a great example of me, of first them understanding the complexity of the issue and really coming up with a solution that sort of made some sense, that here was an opportunity to like relocate them in a way that they were no longer going to be a threat to the garden. It was inspiring to see how children could think so creatively, and how their world of fantasy could lead them to really understanding the complexity of the problem.
I'm just thinking about how you have always asked questions that I don't know have ever been asked before. And and I love listening to that. And the complexity piece seems to always be a part of the stories that you tell.
Thank you, Sandy.
Thank you for sharing that. I want to jump to when you and I went to Reggio together. And I'm thinking about what almost feels like the beginnings of my knowing that you were thinking so much about technology and young children. I remember standing in one of the preschools and you starting to talk a little bit about that with me. And I'm thinking about, how did this technology aspect of your role emerge? How has it changed over time? And what can technology look like in a constructivist early childhood environment?
When we traveled to Reggio together, I was asking some questions about technology. And they had a great opportunity for us to play with some of the technology that they had. But I think that my journey with technology really began during COVID lockdown. But it was a really bizarre time in early childhood. It was a really bizarre time in the world. And I remember these first moments when we all went into lockdown. And then all of a sudden, educators found themselves trying to lead some sort of learning through like Zoom. I felt like we were sort of pioneers in this uncharted territory, and we were all just like throwing stuff out and trying to figure out what worked. I found it really interesting. I found it to be a really interesting time. I felt like we were traveling in this sort of foreign land, and we had this opportunity to look at our own practices with a new perspective. There was a lot of concern that, you know, this really couldn't be our philosophy, that just because we were on Zoom, that it really had to be teacher-directed learning. And there was a lot of questions about whether it could be experiential and how we could really honor our philosophy. And I just found that question so intriguing, of whether or not our constructivism and our Reggio-inspired philosophy could survive in this virtual world. And I remember one day we were in a Zoom chat. I was with this classroom, my classroom at the time. I think we were doing some sort of game. I think it was something around, I don't know, letters or something. It wasn't a terribly interesting day. And very short, I introduced the game and I unmuted the other teachers that were also present. We start to play this game. And then all of a sudden, I hear this tiny little voice say, "Josh, I unmuted myself. I unmuted myself." And that was like the first time that a kid had figured out how to work with the control settings.
Yeah, this was really early.
Yeah, it was really early on. I think it was 3 weeks into lockdown.
Yeah.
And I just had this sort of moment of panic, realizing that these control settings were actually some sort of like management tool that I no longer had control over. And so I kind of like scan the boxes and I realize that it's this kid named Toby, and he's very excited. His friends are also like trying to figure out how he unmuted himself, and he's describing to them how he unmuted himself. And as he's describing it, another kid unmutes themselves. And pretty soon, like my whole structured idea of what that day was going to look like just went out the window. And it all became about them teaching each other how to unmute themselves. And when we ended that day, I felt like I had completely lost control. And I was kind of concerned about how the rest of our sessions were going to go. But then I also realized that this was exactly what I was looking for, that they were actually collaborating and constructing learning together. And that this was really something that shouldn't be discouraged. When we went back into the session the next time, I decided to sort of keep an open mind to what had occurred there. And although I had some other game planned for that day, it was something about memories. I had brought all
photos. I remember.
Yeah. I had photos. Exactly. I had photos from the year, and I wanted to bring them up and see what the kids remembered about them. And they could remember, you know, what we were doing at that time. And I pulled up the first photo in the slide deck, and all of a sudden I see this like green line just cross the screen. And I really didn't know what exactly was happening. You know, do you remember at the time there was this concern about like Zoom pirates?
Yeah.
Like they could take over your screen at any time. And I thought, oh no, it's happened. The Zoom pirates have come. And then I hear this laughter, and I realize that one of the kids, the same kid who had unmuted himself, had figured out how to draw across the Zoom screen. And so I decided to embrace it, having, you know, realizing that kids taking control of the Zoom screen was actually something that could really be beneficial. And so I asked Toby, you know, I didn't even know you could draw on a Zoom screen. Can you teach us how are you doing that? And he goes on to describe exactly what, you know, how to access the drawing function, and other kids start to draw on the screen. And this became sort of our work for the next couple sessions, the kids teaching each other how to draw on the screen. And we started working on sort of collaborative murals. And there was this point where, you know, everybody had like, some kids were on phones and some kids were on Macs and some kids were on Windows. And there was this point where we weren't just learning how to draw on the screen, but we were figuring out how each operating system kind of worked and how you had to access those functions. At the time, we were having meetings at school, kind of sharing what was happening in these Zoom sessions. And I tell all the teachers in the school what's going on. And all the teachers were like, "What are you talking about? You can draw?" And so they were like, "Can you teach us how to do it?" And I'm like, "Well, I might be able to teach you, but I know someone who can teach you even better." And that's where we brought in Toby to help some of the teachers access some of these functions so that they could teach their kids.
What a beautiful message.
Yeah, so I think that is really where I became very curious about the role of technology in the early classroom. And eventually, as you know, we all went back into classrooms. And when we arrived back, the classroom environment was very different than when we remembered. You know, there was so much focus on making sure everything was sterile. And there was a lot of concern about what we could bring into the classroom. The garden had been completely shut down, which seems very odd now, but I think there was a concern that, you know, kids would be playing in the garden and the surfaces of the soil would become contaminated with COVID. And it just seemed so stark. And I had started working with a teacher and we had been assigned a class together. And I think we both felt how stark this environment was. And we both had sort of a curiosity about technology. And I think the way we began is, how could we revisit the garden without actually going to the garden? It started with, projections of the garden and revisiting that space and introducing elements of play and building on these projections.
You can share her name, by the way, the teacher.
Oh, yeah. Stephanie Lean. We started to explore elements of storytelling using projection and sound to create more richness to a space that had to really stay sterile. But I think really our turning point in that year was we had this projection screen and we decided that we were going to invite a family in to celebrate a birthday. Because you remember at that time, families couldn't be in the classroom. So we were like, this would be great. Let's have a family join us. And we invited this family to join us for their son's birthday. And it was kind of a surprise. And we're all eating snack. And all of a sudden, this child's family materializes on the back wall. And because it's a projection, they're like life size. And I think we were all sort of just shocked at how real it felt. It was very, very sort of Star Trek-y. And they joined us and, you know, they joined us as we're eating cake for his birthday. And this was kind of the first time that they had seen the classroom. It just kind of blew us away about how we could really bring in visitors into our class by using all this virtual technology. I had once had this classroom that was Reggio inspired in its design, and it had this window. And on one side, you could see a toddler classroom. And on the other side, there was another window where you could see an infant classroom. And the whole idea behind these windows were this transparency between classrooms. And the idea was that the sparks of what was happening within the classrooms would sort of fly between classrooms. And I think when we invited this family in, we realized that we had this really big window that could open up to really any place in the world. And after that, nothing was the same. You know, we were having art lessons with someone in Florida. We went to the planetarium in Youngstown, and there was a community in Uganda that we met with. We were meeting with grandparents. There was one time that we took a tractor ride with a grandfather and gardened with a grandma. It just seemed sort of limitless.
So fast forward to now, and this is a few years later, I know that you in this role are going in and working in different classrooms and with different educators, collaborating. Can you talk a little bit about that unique role of being able to be a part of many different classrooms and how you can interject and be a partner with the classrooms without just coming in with some random plan that you've made outside of knowing who everybody is, different from a nature teacher or, you know, sort of art teacher in a school. How is this role different?
I say that we look through the lens of nature and technology, but really, I think we consider ourselves thinking partners with teachers, and I think we approach and children a lot of conversations. I think that teachers get very isolated in their classrooms, and it's very easy to be in these sort of isolated satellites where there's no communication between classrooms, no communication between educators. And I think it's really our goal to try to find common threads between those classrooms to try to build a shared culture. We're coming towards the end of the year right now. I realized that we all have these budgets, like classroom budgets. And I came to realize that there were a lot of teachers that had budgets left over where they could buy materials. And I saw this as an opportunity that we could maybe embark on a shared experience. And I thought, you know, why won't we all get caterpillars? And why won't we kind of go through this process together as a school? And I really like the metaphor, as kids are leaving their classrooms and going into new classrooms, kids are leaving our school and going into kindergarten. I felt like, you know, maybe this transformation, this metaphor could be helpful. So it's been great, this sort of shared conversation, as we're all going through this at the same time. And I think it's been our job to sort of share what, make sure that we're making visible what's happening in the different classrooms. I feel like it's our job to make sure that we're sharing the conversations that are happening within the individual classrooms with the whole school, to make it feel as if we're part of a much larger, bigger conversation. And I feel like this conversation is really continues to shape sort of who we are as a school, and what our culture is as a school, is trying to find these gaps and sort of threading them together.
And really showing how children see themselves in the natural world around us, and how and really sharing with us how they see the world is so very incredible, but also helping everyone, children, families, teachers, develop that kind of empathy for the world as it's emerging, the metamorphosis you're finding within the problems, the totally unexpected things that develop. That's where you find the most opportunities. And I think that we can all really learn something from that. Josh, you leave me with more questions, new perspectives, just the complexity of the relationships that you are describing, and the honoring that you do of young children is really beyond what so many are able to do. And I think we can all be inspired by you. And I'm just so, so grateful that you joined us today to really share your stories, that while it's not stories that we need to copy, it's just the dispositions, the way you are thinking in such intentional and deep ways about the capabilities of children and the world. So thank you. So
thank you, Sandy.
If you would like to know more about my wonderful guests or the Reggio approach, please go to my website at sandylanesconsulting.com, or find us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter.